Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, KEYS. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
So here I am, get in the driver's seat, three other guys in a Humvee. The passenger was kind of like that Coach Turner personality, right? Like, it's a guy like you respect. You want to get his approval. He was a quiet dude, didn't say much. And he was the one, the commander for that particular Humvee. There was a guy sitting behind him, and then there was a gunner. It sits up on top of the Humvee with the 50 cal mounted up top. And, you know, we cut up in the Humvee. And, you know, like I always tell people, when you're away from freedom and family and friends, the thing that comes in to replace those things is humor. And you got to find ways to just distract your mind a little bit and just laugh at silly stuff, things that you probably would never laugh at about at home, but you got to find something. And I just remember I was just like clowning around, joking, just cutting up. Right? I mean, just cutting up, like, you know, just going through the motions. And then all of a sudden, boom, the front left tire of the Humvee that I was driving ran over a roadside bomb.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com.
So moving on from your dad, I think that one of the other things that really struck me about your story was the influence that football had on your life. And You say that in a town like Dalton High School, sports brings the community together and football is huge. Football means a sense of honor, pride, and tradition. Buzz Bissinger's best-selling book, Friday Night Lights, An Account of School in Dillon, Texas, could have described Dalton too. And it's kind of funny because I grew up in Bryan College Station, and it was kind of a similar vibe. I mean, it's not as intense as maybe, say, like a West Texas or small town. But talk to me about that experience. Like, because I think the thing that struck me most and probably why I fell in love with Friday Night Lights was that it was such an accurate depiction of that whole experience, because I've seen it firsthand. I was in marching band, and I remember watching that show thinking, I'm like, I can match one character to every single student in the school that I was at till ninth grade. And I could tell you each one of them was like, oh, this guy was Smash Williams. This guy was, this girl was Lila Garrity. Like, I literally had it. So tell me about the impact that had on your life.
Well, man, sports and specifically football, which was the sport that I played consistently since I was a kid, man. I mean, it was my lifeline, and it was the thing that kept me out of trouble. And, you know, was I the kid that was athletic enough to go to the pros? No. But here's something that I think is really fascinating. So when I was, you know, I was born in Louisiana, grew up in Arkansas, and then moved to Georgia my senior year of high school. And so a lot of people, when they hear that, they think military family. And I'm like, nope, just looking for better spaces, job opportunities for my mom, et cetera. Well, when I started playing football, I was in Arkansas, and I was around 9 years old when I started playing. And, you know, listen, there was a lot of, and we've already unpacked a lot of my youth and sort of the challenges that I experienced, but there was a lot of adversity, right? And so I was one of the first Hispanic kids in the community where I grew up in Arkansas. There was a lot of bullying. There was a lot of me getting my ass jumped and kicked just by you know, then there was more Hispanic kids that rolled into the community, and then they would sort of whoop my ass because I wasn't cool enough for them. And I was just kind of like this easy target because I was by myself. And sports was the escape for me. Football was the escape. Football was the opportunity for me to get away. And I remember I got into trouble when I was around 14, 15, 16. Like, I would stay out late and I wasn't doing anything crazy. I was just hanging out at my friend's house or hanging out at the park or running around in the streets, but I wasn't doing anything illegal or committing, you know, any crime or anything. But my mom had this fear being a single mother. And so she was always like, you got to be home by, you know, whatever time before it gets dark. And I remember there was a couple times where I didn't come home. I came home after that. And my mom and I got into a big argument, and she was like, you know what? If you want to be in the streets, then go in the streets. And I was like, fine. And this is like me being a stubborn, tough little teenager asshole. And I was like, fine. And I packed my stuff and I left and I went and stayed at my friend's house. And I went to school every day, still went to school. And I didn't talk to my mom for a couple of days. Wow. And then after a couple of days, my mom came and pulled me out of school one day. And then we were having this powwow. And she was like, that's it. I'm pulling out of football. And she called my coach and said, I'm pulling him out of football. And he said, and trust me, by no means was I, that were they going to feel the impact of my absence. Like, this team was loaded. Like, I was a personality and I was just a good energy dude. Like, that was fine. That was it. I knew my role. And my coach said, told my mom, don't take him out of football. Football, if he doesn't have football, where is he going to be? Where is he going to go? Then he's going to do all the things you're worried about. So keep him there. I'll like run his ass. I will take care. I will tire his ass out so much at practice that when he gets home, he has no time or energy to go anywhere else. My mom was like, okay. And football was the thing that I remember being a kid. And they ask you, what do you want to be when you grow up? You know, that famous exercise that people do.
Yeah.
And I wrote, I want to be a professional football player. That was my goal because that's what I saw on TV. And, you know, football was the thing that just kept me away from trouble, man. It really did. And when I moved to Georgia my senior year of high school, like, football was big in Hope, Arkansas. It was huge, especially because we had a good team.
Yeah.
And we went to the state championship our junior year and I remember I was like, when we moved to Georgia my senior year of high school, here's what's really cool about football. So I went to this school. There's three schools in Dalton, Georgia that you could have attended. And everyone told me, this is the school for football. This is the school, Dalton High School, Catamounts. And I was like, all right. So I go there. I take a tour of the school. I like it. I asked the principal, all right, I want to play football. Who's the football coach? She says, here's his number. I call him. His name is Coach McClurg. I call him. I say, hi, coach. This is my name. I just moved here. I'd like to try out for the football team. And he says, what year are you going to go into? I said, I'm going to be a senior. And he says, well, unless you're a starter or first team sub, we don't take walk-on seniors. And I said, that's cool. I understand that. I said, all I'm asking for is an opportunity. Let me just come and try out. He said, okay. Now here's the thing. I was not 100%. I had injured my ankle in my junior year of football, where I had to have surgery on my ankle. And so I wasn't 100%. I just came out of PT and was still kind of hobbling and couldn't really run a 40 full sprint. So I go out to this practice that was a tryout for me, not for anybody else. And I didn't know anybody. Nobody knew me. For all they knew, I was a freshman, you know, just like, they didn't know who I was. And I didn't know who any of these dudes were. And I just kept noticing this pattern where guys would make mistakes or they wouldn't do something the way they wanted to, and they would keep their heads down. And I would go to them like, you know, hey, man, come on, man, you got this. Like, hey, next one, next one, next one, right? Just keeping the energy up. And literally after practice, the coach calls me to his office and he says, I want you to know you made the team. And I say, well, how is that? Like, I'm not even 100%. I can't even do a full sprint out there. He said, you didn't make the team because of your ability to play football. You made the team because of your attitude.
Yeah.
And I was like, what does that even mean? Like, right? Like, I didn't even know what that meant, but I didn't care. I was the senior in high school in this new school. I was on a football team. I was going to have a jersey. Like, that was going to help me, you know, be accepted in this new school and this new environment. And it did. But here's the cool thing. If you ever go back and you were to, I mean, I haven't, but if you were able to see footage of Friday night games, and you would never see J.R. Martinez on the field making this big play. Oh my God, he's going to the 10, to the 5, touchdown, J.R. Martinez. Or J.R. Martinez made this big tackle, or J.R. Martinez saved the game, or whatever. No, if you pan to the sidelines, that's where J.R. Martinez made his presence felt. Seriously. Like, I was the dude 100% on Friday night. Like, when the energy was down, I stood on the bench and I got the crowd pumped up, excited. I was like, come on, get loud. When dudes came off the field, I'm like in their ear. Like, before they went onto the field, I was in their ear. I was essentially a cheerleader just in football match. Like, that was it. And then to the point where I remember, like, I'd already been part of a team that went to the state championship, so I knew what it took.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was the only one that really had that experience. So I was bringing that experience over to this team, and I was trying to elevate them by just like, hey, man, come on, like keep your heads up, keep your attitude positive. Like, we got, like, whatever, everyone embracing their role, to the point where I remember when we got closer to the tail end of the season and it was now like, okay, we're going to go into the playoffs. Every time you had practice and you scouted against like the freshmens, right? Like the freshmens, if you're on defense, the freshmens were the offensive quarterback, running back, receivers, linemen. And these dudes are afraid of the seniors or juniors, and they're like not going full speed. And I went to the coach and I was like, coach, let me be tailback on scout team offense. And he was like, no, you're a senior. That's not what seniors do. That's what freshmen and some sophomores do. And I was like, I don't care. They're not running full speed. You think those dudes are going to just let them tackle them the way that so he was like, okay, dude, I put those pads on. I was a running back and I just started running over our dudes. Like, I just started like laying into dudes' chest. And what was really cool is here I was in this new community where it was hard for me to, you know, be accepted, especially my senior year. And there's all these expectations senior year. This is what your life is going to be like, or you expect it to be like. And what was really dope is that community embraced me. And that's the thing I love about communities that embrace, like, football, for example, in this case, because they just support you 100%. And you really start to feel that community and that camaraderie and that support. Where I remember the first couple months of me being in this new environment, I was in the paper. I was literally in the paper. And they had this full feature of me because I was this new kid on the team. I was a senior. This is the role I was playing and how impactful it was. But again, stats wise, I had no stats. Like, I barely played, but I influenced that team and we went all the way to the state championship. And I can tell you that it was so awesome because it was my avenue, one, to, like I said, stay out of trouble, but it was also my avenue to feel like I was a part of something and have a community of people, which is the thing that I've been looking for my entire youth. All I wanted was to have community and to feel unconditional love. And there was literally, I wrote a post about this the other day on my Instagram, and I talked about unconditional love. And there was, I swear to you, at least 5 people that texted me from Georgia, from that community, that said, hey, we saw this post. We just want you to know we unconditionally love you. Wow. And these are people that were part of that football community. They were football parents, right? That they have looked at me as one of their own. And so sports, it wasn't my way out, like in a sense of I'm going to get a full ride. I'm going to be able to go pro one day and take care of my family. But it instilled so many incredible, like, things in me, and it allowed me to identify certain things as far as like identifying your role and embracing that role, even if it's not going to be the star player on the team, right? It's a team sport. If you're going to pout and be upset about your stats, then go play an individual sport. But I was a part of a team and I identified, this is the role I play. I don't need to be that big dude. I don't need to try to be that big dude. This is who I am. It allowed me to understand the importance of having a positive attitude. I got an opportunity because of my attitude, because the way that I showed up. It taught me about leadership. I didn't go out there and pat those dudes on the butt and on the helmet to be like, hey, come on, you got this. Because I wanted people to acknowledge me. I did it because I felt like, hey, I understand what it's like to be in that situation where you want to do better. And if you can have someone come up and encourage you, that's everything. And it also just allowed me to say, hey, listen, sometimes goals are not there to actually come to fruition. They're actually there to guide you to get to a point in your life that then at that point, you're going to discover what you're really supposed to be doing.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
If that makes sense.
That does, yeah. Yeah, so like basically in my mind, I'm thinking, so you weren't Jason Street, you weren't Matt Saracen, probably you were like a Landry Clark.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Well, Landry Clark, 100%. Yep. 100%.
Yeah. Well, yeah, so one other question about football, and then we'll get into your time in the military and to your injury. So like one of the things that I always wondered about, there are two things in my own experience with this. I think, you know, we were joking about it the other day, like growing up in Texas, like seventh graders the size of grown men. Like I was an idiot who stuck it out an entire season, but like found ways to get out of practice, you know, constantly. Cause like the only way you could leave was if you're, you know, you needed to be tutored. I didn't need to be tutored for shit. I was a straight A student, but, and then my friend was like, you can be the backup kicker, which basically meant nothing, you know, like, but I still remember to this day, like they did those tackling drills and some kid pushed me back like 20 yards. The whole team laughed and I was just like, all right. But the thing that never happened was nobody pulled me aside and talk to me about the idea that I could get better. Right. Even though the coach in eighth grade called me that summer, and I remember answering the phone, and he's like, hey, Shreen, it's Coach Powers. And I'm, why the fuck is Coach Powers calling me? He was like, are you coming out for football this year? Because in our town, they split all the, we were all in different schools. Like every year I was there, we were in a different school, like fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, and ninth grade. I went to a different school. The year I got to eighth grade, they built three junior highs. So it was sixth, seventh, and eighth. And so I was like, oh, I know why you're calling me, because when you're fucking like backup, you need a backup for when your students fail. And I'm like, I'm not going to be Matt Saracen. Like, there's just no way. But I think the thing that I realized is nobody ever told me that I could get better. Whether it was, you know, I played basketball because I was like, okay, I hear I'm not going to get the hell beat out. That I always wondered about. Like, and when you see these guys like who are in the position, like the quarterback of a team who leads a team to a high school state championship, like what is that guy's like mindset, work ethic? Like what differentiates him from the rest of the team? Or, you know, not to be like, you know, obnoxious, but what differentiates him from you?
Right. Yeah. No, you know, it's, you know, I coach my daughter's softball team and it's select ball, club ball, travel ball, whatever people call it. And I'm constantly, you know, cause I connect with that. Like, as far as like, never approached me and said, this is how you can improve, JR. This is, you are athletic enough where you could actually be a good player. Like, you're not getting a scholarship to go to a big school, right? Like, you're not. Yeah. Like, that's okay. And but I could have played D2 ball, probably. I probably could have easily done that, and depending on the position, of course. But no one ever approached me and said, hey, man, these are areas that you need to work on. And that's why for me as a coach to this softball team, I'm going to every single kid and I'm like, hey, these are areas you got to improve on. Like, I don't know what your goals are, whether your goals are just to survive this season, whether your goals are, because these are, you know, fifth and sixth graders, some seventh, if your goals are to play in high school, if your goals are to play in college, and now softball's starting to have a bigger presence that maybe you could play this on the professional circuit. I don't know what your goals are, but I'm telling you, in order to get through this season and wherever your goals are, this is the areas you got to work on. These are the ways that you have to improve. And really breaking it down for kids and then giving them isolated reps to help them be able to improve in that area. And it's really cool because then as a coach, it's so gratifying to, in a game scenario, to see it come into fruition where you're like, there it is. You did it. That's what you've been working on. And you can just see their smiles, man. And you just like all, and you're just kind of part of a foundation where they feel supported. They feel like they have encouragement. They feel like they have people that believe in them. And that is such a beautiful thing and an important thing for a child to feel. But I'm also, like I told you, like, I mean, listen, we got one of our star players. We played recently. One of our star players, she was upset because she individually was not doing as well as she would have liked in an area of the game. And then what it did is it kind of affected other, like her defense. So what I did is I pulled her. I took her out. And I took like our star player out. One of our star players. I took her out. And she was pouting and everything. And that's when I gave this speech. I was like, listen. And I like, listen, you want to sit here and pout? Meanwhile, your team is like literally blowing the top off of this game right now. We're beating a team by 12 runs. That's incredible. We're having this is insane what we're doing right now. And you're still over there pouting, can't even celebrate with your team. Then this might not be either the right team for you or this is not the right sport for you. And I think that kids have to, I think there's a condition where kids, they're coddled so much, right? Like, like, oh, that's a star player. You don't want to upset them or upset their parents. And I'm like, no, this is bigger than softball. This is bigger than the sport that you're playing. Like, you have to understand you are not bigger than anybody else on this team. You are not. Your skill set is not bigger than it. It's not going to allow you to get away with having a bad attitude or being a bad teammate in this moment. We got to fix this right now. And I think that what you start to identify is which kids are able to bounce back from that. Yeah. Which kids really want it? And kids that are able to embrace that and then actually say, I got it, coach. My bad, coach. All right, coach. And then turn the key and get to the other side of it. I think those are the kids that go off to be the quarterbacks that lead, you know, a team to the national championship, state championship, whatever it may be, right? You got to have a different gear and you got to be able to understand that everything is moments in life, right? It's all moments. And we as human beings, and especially as kids, because they don't have the tools quite yet, they turn moments into permanent periods. And it literally turns into this extended, like, oh, this thing is so horrible because of what happened 4 weeks ago. And you're like, kid, as a moment, like learn from it and move on, right? And I think that's, for me, one of the biggest things I try to do is yes, I'm coaching you to play softball and be a better softball player, but we're really talking about life.
Yeah.
Like that's really what we're talking about here.
Totally. Well, it's funny because, like, you know, hearing you say all this, I kind of think back to my seventh grade basketball team where I was like, I was the most improved player, which just meant I was the shittiest player on the team. Not like Jimmy Butler in the NBA. When he's the most improved player, it means something. But like, you know, I played for two seasons and I stuck it out. And, I remember I practiced, like, even my math teacher was like, you're actually better when I got to eighth grade. And I guess like for me, and it was funny because the team I was on in eighth grade, we lost every single game. And the one game that always stands out in my mind, we played our crosstown rival junior high and we lost 48-7 in a basketball game. And you know what? Two of those 7 points were mine. And like, the craziest thing, like I literally ran to the side, like almost to the 3-point line, ended up backwards hook, like a shot that had like no prayer of go again. My coach was about to yell at me and the shot went in and he was like, curriculum. He still thought I was an idiot for doing that. But like, you know, I think you share some really valuable insights on that whole process. Cause I can tell you, I have talked to probably at least a dozen people who are like top of their game, Tim Ferriss, Chase Jarvis, every one of them, like high school sports teams. And you know, you're talking about the team. It's like finding an individual sport. I'm like, yeah, that's why I surf and snowboard, because if I'm having a shitty day, it doesn't bring your performance down.
Yeah. Well, you know, like, I mean, it's funny because I played basketball a little bit too, and I was never the dude that had like handles. I could shoot a little bit, but I wasn't like a create space guy. I was more of like a spot up shooter coming off, rolling off of a screen and, you know, be able to throw it up. And I was like a streaky shooter. That was my thing. And then it's just a scrappy dude, like defensive wise, like that's, I just had that energy. Right.
Yeah.
And I remember I think it would have been seventh grade for me. There was this coach, his name was Coach Turner, and he coached basketball, football, he coached track. And this dude, like, I mean, this dude didn't cut up with you. Like there was like, you know, but Coach Turner was like that guy that I respected. He was that coach that I respected him, and I wanted him to. You know, not that I was seeking his approval or anything of that nature. Like it wasn't that deep, I don't think. I mean, it possibly was, but it definitely was one of those things where I was like, I want to do good for him, yeah. Right? Like he was somebody that I respected his opinion. And he coached the basketball team. I'm on it. He puts me in the game. I never forget. We run a play. I'm supposed to come to the top of the, top of the free throw line. And then dish it out, right? And so I panic. I like freak out. Like I just freeze. And they pass me the ball. I'm standing at the top. And dude, I just turn around and do like a fadeaway, like a Jordan. And just, I mean, literally, if I had a hammer in my hand and someone said, hey, put a nail on that backboard, that's how hard I hit that backboard. And it wouldn't have a shot of going in. It just like, wing. But my natural reflex was to laugh. Not because I thought it was funny, because I was nervous and I was like, I just screwed up. So I'm running literally to the other end of the court, like a little smirk on my face. Cause I'm like, oh, I just screwed up. It wasn't like, oh, this is funny, I don't care. No, it was like, I screwed up. And it's kind of like this nervous, you know, laugh that I had. And literally Coach Turner called timeout, pulled my ass right off the game, sat me at the end of the bench. And I never forget that, right? I never forget that. And to your question earlier, like, I think that's why for me, like, and he never came up to me afterwards and said, hey man, why'd you do that? Why'd you shoot that shot? You knew the play. Why? Like, help me understand. And then I would have probably told him, coach, I just got nervous. I just froze up. My bad. Like, I'm sorry. And then we could have like maybe worked on that. Yeah. And for me, I will chew a kid out. Like, I'm like, listen, at the end of the day, kids thrive off of discipline. Like they do. Like, I mean, there's within reason, right? I'm not saying like start, you know, beating kids, but I will tell my kids, including my own on the softball field, I'm like, hey, you got to make that play. Like, come on. Like, hey, you got to hit your cut. Hey, you got it, whatever it is.
Yeah.
But when they come off the field, guess what I'm doing? I put my arm around them. Hey, let's step away from the team for a second. Let's talk about what happened right there. Why'd you do this? Why'd you do that? Hey, at practice. Hey, let's break down this play. what happened here? Why did you do this? What were you thinking? And I think that's why I do that so much, because if I would have had coaches like that, that said, listen, man, you screwed up. All right, whatever. But let's really break it down as to why you screwed up. Let's really understand, help me understand, and then coach you up a little bit. No one ever did that. It was just me just going with it. And I think, you know, when kids are able to have a presence like that in their life, I mean, that's everything, man. I mean, I have kids that I've been coaching, you know, that no longer play for me just because I moved to a different organization, and I see them in the community and they're always like, coach, they still call me coach. They don't even play softball anymore, but they remember when they were in, you know, fourth, fifth, sixth grade, and I coached them, how they fell in love with the game and how they, it, like, there's such good fond memories of that. And I'm like, that's what sports has the opportunity to do. Not everyone's going to have the opportunity to go, you know, even play at the college level, let alone go pro, right? But you do have the ability to play and enjoy the sport and actually learn some lessons that you can carry with you no matter what you find yourself getting into.
Yeah.
Wow. And more coaches need to understand that. That's where I think the coaches, especially like in parents, you know, because I'm a parent that became a coach, right? And I'm a parent in one section, but I'm also a coach. Like half the time, someone the other day was like, how's your daughter doing? And I'm like, I mean, she's good, but I really haven't spent a lot of time thinking about her because I have to think about 11 kids. And like, but I know she's playing well, like, but I couldn't tell you stats. I couldn't tell you, like, I just, because I'm thinking of the 11 girls. And I think that's the problem when you have coaches that, especially when you get to a certain level and there's compensation involved, you know, where they're just focused on their job and you're missing the mark. You're missing the mark. That we have one kid. She's probably the 11th best player on our team. She's probably spot number 11. And in one of our tournaments, man, we were playing a high ranking team and we're in the championship game and it's intense. It's close. It's a defensive battle. And she comes up to bat and I'm like, and I'm at third base and I'm trying to give her, you know, simple tips so she can make those adjustments. And dude, she not only came up with a huge hit that drove in runs and gave us the lead. Then on defense, she's in the outfield and a ball smoked to her. And every time she would be in the outfield and the ball was hit to her, I'd always like, oh, come on. Like I'm her dad, like her mom. And I'm like, come on. And then she made the catch. And I was like you literally won this game for us. But you don't know how much time I invested in that kid. I didn't like deflate that kid and tell her, God, like you're just here just to practice and give us an extra body. But, you know, like I encouraged that kid and I worked with that kid, and that kid at the very end helped our team win a championship. And that kid's going to carry that for the rest of her life. And that's what it should be about when you find yourself in a position to influence kids playing sports.
Wow. Well, let's talk about the military in particular, and I think that we'll get into your injury from there. I think, you know, what I'm always curious about when I talk to people from the military is, what is the difference between what we see on TV and the news and in the movies versus the reality of what's happening on the ground? Like, what do we not see, man?
Not to get too heavy into this, but I think one of the biggest things you don't see is you don't see a lot of the pain. You know, I mean, that's obviously a big talking point in the military space, as far as like from a mental health and just really just being there for each other. And, you know, you don't see that depicted in films or in TV shows. I mean, it's there, man. I mean, you see it all the time. I mean, you see guys break down, you see guys hurting because somebody got injured, because somebody unfortunately, you know, made the ultimate sacrifice. And that's not shown enough. And I think people just assume that we're trained so well that we can just be robotic and just go through the motions and just show up, right? And that's not true. We carry that stuff because, of course, we're humans. I think, you know, probably another thing is, I mean, everyone, I think, understands physically how hard it is to be in the military. Listen, I would say every job, but yes, there are some jobs that are not as physically demanding or even mentally, emotionally demanding as others. But for the most part, people don't understand how mentally, the training, how difficult that is, right? Think about when you go to basic training and you literally have, and I was an infantryman. I was front lines. I was trained to fight. Now, listen, I joined the military. I was in high school, senior year of high school when 9/11 happened. I'm not going to say it was the sole reason why I joined the military. It was part of the reason why I joined the military. I wanted to give back to a country that I was indebted to, that had given so much to me and my family. My mother's from Central America. My father, as you know, is from Mexico. I understood and I had perspective as a kid of the importance of protecting and defending this country and doing whatever I could to contribute to that. I also knew the military was an opportunity for me to travel, for me to get money for college. There was just it was just a win-win at that stage of my life. And so I go off into the Army and I enlisted for 3 years. And I remember, I picked infantry because I was like, shit, I want to go fight. And I go off to basic training and literally the first three-ish weeks, you got grown men in your face just yelling at you. Literally like making you do every exercise that you could possibly think of for literally hours. And then like, okay, go to bed. And they turn off the lights and you literally 11 minutes in, you're finally falling asleep and they kick the lights back on. They come in banging like trash cans and getting you up. The mental exhaustion. All they're doing is like, hey, we got to filter out the people that can't cut this. And there's one dude, I can't tell you how many guys I remember seeing cry. And that was the first time I had been around a bunch of boys, like, cause we were still young men, boys, like we're crying. One dude pissed himself. It's like, you just don't understand mentally what it does. And they have to sort of strip your mental identity of who you were and to allow the room to train you to become a troop, a service member, a soldier, a sailor, a marine, an airman, that's what they have to do. And think about this. And this is something that, and I feel like this is a space where I can share this. I don't share it for every space because I don't think it's just not for every space. But I remember when I deployed to Iraq, and this is 6 months after I enlisted, and three of those months I was in basic training, and one like 2.5 weeks I was home for the holidays, and then I was in my unit for like 2.5-ish months before I deployed. So it all happened fairly quick for me. And I remember as we were going through briefings of situational, I remember they said, when we're on a convoy in people, what they will try to do is they will sacrifice either themselves, they will sacrifice women. In some cases, they will sacrifice children. And as you're driving, they will try to stand in front of your Humvee because the goal is to get you to stop because then you're a target, right? And I remember my sergeant, as I'm sitting there listening to him, he said, guys, you don't stop. And I'm like, wait, what? And I literally raised my hand. I was like, wait, clarify that. What do you mean? And he's like, you don't stop. He's like, doesn't mean you push on the gas. It doesn't mean like, it just, I'm just saying you kind of nudge them, right? You just kind of just keep it moving. You can't stop because now you put yourself and everybody else at risk. And I'm literally trying to wrap my head around how 3 years ago I got my license and very clearly it said that pedestrians have the right of way and you have to stop even for the jerk that doesn't even wait for you to like just decide, oh, pedestrians have the right of way so I can just walk into the street. And if you don't stop or, then they look at you like, what are you doing? And you're like, dude, just because you have the right of way doesn't mean you just walk out into the street. You also have to, there's rules to this nonsense. But over there, it was like, no. And like, think about what it takes mentally to recalibrate your mind to go from a civilian kid to now being in combat at war. and understanding that strategy. I mean, that's the stuff that I think people really don't understand. They don't, I mean, think about like when I was injured, and I'm not trying to get too ahead, like no one could right away come to my aid. They had to wait and set up a perimeter to make sure that no one else was going to, you know, try to help me, and then they were going to get injured. Because the way war works from a strategic standpoint is, listen, we want to save our guys, but we can't just rush in, because what happens if someone else, it's an ambush? What if someone else gets injured? What if something happens to somebody else? Now, instead of us losing just Martinez, now we've lost Martinez and whomever else. Yeah. And wars is all about numbers. We need bodies. We can't afford to lose two people. So, you got to set up a perimeter. You got to sort of see what's going on and really assess the situation. And then once you sort of cleared everything, then you can try to, but at that point it could be too late. And just think about mentally what that does. Think about how service members, men and women, depending on your field, live with guilt because they're like, man, I wasn't able to help that person quick enough. Or, I mean, that's the stuff that I don't think people really understand. And the reason why I think that people don't understand that is because it's evident when service members come home and they're dealing with a lot of this guilt, a lot of the mental health, a lot of the trauma they've been exposed to. There's really no services there to support them and help them to cope with that, to deal with that, to address that, so they can go on and hopefully live somewhat of a productive life in the civilian world, as we call it. And so, you know, like there's that stripping of who you were, your identity when you joined the military, but there's no stripping of who you become in the military to get you back to being a human being.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah. What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Yeah. I did a training session for a group of people who were retired special forces guy. One of my listeners ran a nonprofit that helped them transition to civilian careers. And the thing that I kept hearing over and over again was like the biggest thing. I remember this guy told me, he's like, I don't have my gym anymore. What I got the sense was the community that had helped them have this identity was gone. And that was like the hardest thing for them, was the fact that. And I asked another friend who's in that same group, you know, who lived close by, I'd surfed with him a few times. And he said, the thing is that like you go through that experience together. He said, there's no company, no organization where you will have that kind of bond with people. And that's one of the hardest transitions that that people have to make. Well, tell me about the injury, because, you know, I think that that's kind of what was the impetus for the book and everything else. So what exactly happened? I know what happened, but tell our listeners what happened.
Yeah. So, you know, early on, we were, I'll share this quick story with you because, I like to believe that I live with intention, and although sometimes I get away from it, but for the most part, I like to, you know, I like to show up and live with intention. And I think one of the things that I've identified is that the reason why every time I have an interaction with somebody, people feel like, man, he made me feel like I was the only person in the room. And people say that I'm approachable and all these things. And there's a reason why. It's because I have felt how different people have impacted me. And I know what it did for me. And so I try to be that to other people. So I remember like early, you know, when I was deployed, you know, a couple of my sergeants, I mean, just not accessible. And what I mean accessible is like just emotional. Like they just, like even as a leader, like they sort of dismissed a lot of things, like questions that I would ask. And I just trying to understand war and combat. And, you know, it got to the point, man, where I was like, you know what? I'm tired of this. I don't want to do this anymore. I can't wait till my deployment to be done. And I just kept going through the motions every day. And then one day getting a briefing by a commander, and this guy literally talked about this. He introduced the concept of service to me. He introduced this concept of being a part of something bigger than myself, owning your role. He introduced all these different concepts. And I remember walking away from that briefing and thinking to myself, I'm making a difference here. Like, this is dope. And then that one man gave me that excitement again, and that joy about being in the military, where I was like, you know what? I want to do this for the next 20 years of my life. And when I get home from this deployment, I'm going to go to Ranger school. I want to be special forces. I want to be airborne. I want to be Pathfinder. I want to be, you know, you name it. I want to do all those things. And, there's two sayings, right? There's like, you touched on, like, there's two sayings. Either one, the Mike Tyson route, where it's like everyone has a game plan until they get punched in the mouth. Or there's the faith-based route where, like, you know, you plan, God laughs. Like, whatever. It means the same thing. So, of course, I make a plan thinking this is what I want my life to be. And then on the 5th of April of 2003, we're escorting a convoy to a city called Karbala. So, essentially, our job early on, a lot of what we did was people that weren't in the, you know, specialty of fighting. They had other specialties. You know, they would need to get from point A to point B safely. And we were one of the units that were in charge of, essentially, think about like a barricade. Think about like the escort that a president receives every time they travel, and how you have these cars surrounding him. So you're going to be that first line of defense. You're going to be the one that's going to take the brunt of anything that tries to happen, any sort of threat. Well, that's what we did. I mean, we essentially we knew the route, we had the weapons, we had the training, and we just constantly just surrounded this convoy and protected these people. Who these people were, didn't really know, but I just assumed that there were people that were going to go help other people. And they were, right? Because they were our military. And I took pride in that, man. And I remember on the 5th of April of 2003, I was driving a Humvee and we escorted this convoy to where they needed to go. And we thought, all right, we're done for the day. We're going to drive back to our base camp and then wait for next orders, which is going to be the next day or whatever. And we were told to pull over because we were going to have this new mission. We had to go secure this area. But there was no real route. So we had to, our commanders had to figure out, our leadership had to figure out a route. And I remember we're all outside of our Humvees and we got our weapons and it's a hot day. And I just remember like leaning up against my Humvee and, you know, the sun is like just draining the life out of you. And I'm just getting tired. And finally, I remember they said, all right, we have the route. Everyone get in your Humvees. Martinez, you drive. Yes, Sergeant. And the lieutenant was like, this is the route we're going to take. And the sergeants were like, hey, sir, those routes haven't been cleared yet. We shouldn't go that route. And he's like, pretty much pulled rank. And he said, listen, I outrank you guys. You listen to me. That's the route we're going to take. Now, there's a reason why this is so important. Because that lieutenant smoked me one day while I was in Iraq and gave me this whole briefing about how we're a brotherhood and how we stick together. We're always got each other's back in the battlefield and beyond, right? So here I am. Get in the driver's seat, three other guys in a Humvee. The passenger was kind of like that Coach Turner personality, right? Like it's a guy like you respect, you know, you want to get his, you know, like approval. He was a quiet dude, didn't say much. And I just, and he was the one, the commander for that particular Humvee. There was a guy sitting behind him. And then there was the gunner. It sits up in up on top of the Humvee with the 50 cal mounted up top. And you know, we cut up in the Humvee and, you know, like I always tell people, when you're away from freedom and family and friends, the thing that comes in to replace those things is humor. And you got to find ways to just distract your mind a little bit and just laugh at silly stuff, things that you probably would never laugh at about at home, but you got to find something. And I just remember us just like clowning around, joking, just cutting up. Right? I mean, just cutting up, like, you know, just going through the motions. And then all of a sudden, boom. And what happened was the front left tire of the Humvee that I was driving ran over a roadside bomb. Let me tell you what's so important about that is, so it ran over a landmine, essentially. When I deployed, when I knew I was going to war, I can honestly tell you, and maybe it's just me being naive, I was never afraid of being shot. I mean, we had to train on hand-to-hand combat. So guess what? You still had your knife, right? You still train in case you didn't have your rifle on you or whatever, you still used your bayonet. Like you still had that. And so you trained on hand-to-hand combat. I was never afraid of getting stabbed. I never really even thought about losing my life. The one thing that terrified me to death was a landmine. It just terrified me because the concept of it is it's buried. It's camouflaged if it's done right. And when pressure's applied and then released, it detonates. And that just terrified me. And as much as we went through the training, I would always find myself avoiding that training. I would always get to the back of the line. Like I didn't like messing with them. Like, cause you had to learn how to defuse them. I didn't like doing any of that stuff. I was like, landmines scared the hell out of me, man. And that's how fear works. You give something so much power and it becomes the thing that ends up halting your life, paralyzing your life, in some cases, taking your life. And that was the thing that literally halted my life, rerouted my life, almost took my life. So there's something in that that I just want people to listen to real quick as I continue with the 5th of April. After that explosion, three other troops were thrown out of the vehicle. They all walk away with minor physical injuries. Like the passenger has shrapnel in his body and I think in his hand. The gunner was thrown up into the air and he landed and messed up his legs and he had to, you know, come back to the States to recover from that. But then he went back like probably like 3 months later, he was back in Iraq with the unit. The other guy like got shrapnel, busted up his lip and all sort of scuffed. But I was trapped inside. And we had 50 cal rounds with the 7.62 rounds. I mean, it's a huge, I mean, you're not even supposed to, you know, shoot at people with those. That's against the rules. That's only for like buildings and vehicles and bigger structures. I mean, and those things were heating up and shooting off. We had missiles in the back, tow missiles in the back of our Humvee heating up. Like, I mean, it sounded like a 4th of July show, baby. Here we go. And I'm trapped inside of this Humvee, man, and I'm trapped for 5 minutes, completely conscious, just screaming for someone to please come and pull me out. And there were several moments over the course of those 5 minutes where I just kept telling myself, don't keep your eyes closed, because my eyes would close. I'm like, no, just stay awake, stay alive, keep fighting. Someone's going to come and help you and get you out. And sure enough, 5 minutes after, two of my sergeants actually pulled me out of the Humvee. And the details were, what they did is, because we were in the middle of nowhere and there was no real landing zone because I was going to have to get airlifted. So what they did is they threw me on the hood of another Humvee and drove me to the site where the medevac was. And then they essentially took me from there and they put me into a medical induced coma. And then once I was, from there stable, I left Iraq and I went to Germany, and I was in Germany for 3 days and I was still in this coma. They cut my stomach open along with over 30-ish% of my body having third degree burns. And once I was stable, they brought me back to the United States and I went to the burn center for the military, which is in San Antonio, Texas. And 3 weeks later, man, I came out of my coma and literally to this, like, I was like, where the hell am I? Who are all these people in my room? And why can I sit up by myself? Why can I feed myself? Why can't I can't walk? I can't feel my legs. Like it was, as you can imagine, just traumatic in itself and confusing.
Yeah.
And more things came to light in the couple of days to follow, because once the drugs wore off, then you start to have a little bit more clarity and understanding that you're not going to be allowed to stay in the Army, that you've lost that identity. You've also lost the identity that you've known your entire life, which is your physical identity, your looks.
Mm-hmm.
And listen, man, I was a dude that just, I relied on my looks as a kid. Like that was my thing. Like, it, you know, like I was that kid. And now I'm looking in the mirror and I'm like, who the hell is that? And, you know, naturally you fall into this state of being depressed and angry and resentful. And, you know, it was tough, man. I mean, and that's part of the journey that I think a lot of people don't know about. And, you know, where I would tell everybody, I would have been better off if you just let me die. At least I would have been, you know, remembered as a hero. And let me tell you, so I'm in the hospital initially for 3 months, and there's so many details and things that we can unpack. And I want to circle back on that whole Friday Night Lights. And you talked about how football and community and what that did for me. So again, I only went to Dalton, Georgia for my senior year of high school, was embraced, felt love. Well, I remember after 3 months of being in the hospital, I was allowed to go back to Georgia and just be home, right? They feel like that's the best medicine, get you out of this setting and just go home and be around your family and your friends and then come back. And I was only gone for a month. And I remember that I was traveling. My mom left a few days before me. And so I was going to be traveling with the military liaison. I was going to have this like chaperone, this sergeant. She traveled with me. She just to make sure I could do things. And we had a layover in Chicago. And so we leave San Antonio. We get to Chicago. I get to the gate. Flight's delayed. And I'm anxious. All I want to do is get home because I'm curious. How are people back home going to embrace me? And I'm sitting there at the gate and all of a sudden this guy comes up to me and he says, are you J.R. Martinez? And I said, yes. And he said, hey man, what's up? I'm Chuck. And I was like, Chuck? And he's like, yeah, Coach McClurg's son. So my football coach in Dalton, Georgia, that was his son who was just happened to be traveling back home from a work trip. And here we were at the same gate. So we're cutting it up and we get on the plane. We board the plane. Now we're not getting into Chattanooga, Tennessee, which is the closest airport, till like 11 o'clock at night. Now I'm kind of disappointed because I'm like, man, nobody's going to be there. It's late. And I'm sitting like towards the, I'm in the back of the plane. And I remember the whole, like, I have open wounds on my body, man. Like, I, if I leaned up against the window, like I know this is going to gross out all, some of the listeners, but like there would be like blood just because of open wounds. And I wipe it secretly so to bring no attention. And I remember as we were deplaning, as we got into the jetway, all the people that were on the aircraft seated in front of me were all standing on the sides clapping as I walked through. And I'm like, wait, are they clapping for me? And the chaperone was like, yeah. And I was like, oh, that's how do they know? Like, how do they know? And she didn't answer. And somebody obviously told. And so, you know, I go through, and then as I'm coming out of security, I see my coach. I see a couple of my teammates. And then my mom rolls up and I see like my friends, and I'm just like, man, this is awesome. So then we get in the car and I drive with one of my boys, and my boys has this nice souped up car. And this is, you know, early and Fast and the Furious was still hot and heavy, right? And so my boys had the Honda Civic all souped up and everything. And so I'm driving with my boy, riding with him in the passenger seat, and we exit and the highway to turn down the main road in Dalton, Georgia, which is called Walnut Avenue. And I remember as we're sitting on the exit ramp, we're at a red light, and all of a sudden cops roll up, and my boy from another car gets out. He comes, opens the passenger door, and he's like, hey man, get out. And I was like, what? I was like, dude, we're literally on the exit ramp. He's like, get out, man. And the cops roll up, and I'm like, oh, dude, I'm literally going to jail because of my dumbass friends, like after literally 5 hours of leaving the hospital. And what I didn't see was right behind that cop car was this 1932 replica of a Mercedes-Benz convertible. It was the husband of the high school principal. And this dude looks like straight up like Colonel Sanders, white beard, white hair, everything. He has that real deep Southern accent. And he's like, JJR, get in the car. And my boy, the one that opened the door, he was helping me get in the back of the car. And I realized the police officer was going to be an escort. And so we turned onto Walnut Avenue. And man, let me tell you, dude, people lined up on both sides of the street at 11:30 at night, with signs, clapping, welcome home. Like freaking restaurants didn't even display the special. They said, we're proud of you, JR. We love you, JR. Welcome home, JR. And my boy's having to hold me because I'm so fragile and weak that I could fly off the back of this car. And as we're going down, and I'm just waving at people, and then we start to turn into what used to be the Kmart parking lot. And I'm like, well, it's over, right? And my boy says, no, look. And they later told me there was around 3,500 people. And they had like this makeshift stage, and it was all the dudes I played football with. And they gave me like the key to the city, and all these people came up to the podium and said these awesome things about me. And that's what football and sports did for me, is it allowed me to find that community of people that gave me that incredible welcoming. And you know what it did, man? It kind of instilled in me that if the rest of the world doesn't accept me, doesn't embrace me, judges me, thinks I'm disgusting to look at or even be around, the hell with them. I can always go back to Dalton, Georgia, because that community loves me. And that kind of gave me a little bit of like this, you know, me against the world. Like, you know, I don't care. Like, fine. Cause I got people that are in my corner. I got people that got my back. It was so powerful. And I never forget it. Even when I go back home and I drive down that street, I vividly remember the feeling of having all of those people there to support me and love me and encourage me. And they've just continued to do that throughout everything that I've done. And that's a beautiful thing to have.
Yeah. Well, I think the misinterpretation, if we stop right there, is going to be people going to think, oh, it was all smooth sailing from there. And you and I both know that it's not the case, right? I think one of the things that came up for me as we're going through this is thinking about the role of image in our society, which, you know, is Instagram filtered to no end, and like how we perceive beauty. Because I think the you'd said a couple of things. You already mentioned it, but there are a couple of lines in the book that really caught my attention. You know, you mentioned Christina Aguilera saying, "You're beautiful," which only made me cry. "I cried for the young man I'd been and the person I was now. Even though I hadn't seen my face, burned face or body, I knew that I probably wasn't beautiful anymore. That hurt as almost as much as the physical pain." And, you know, it got me thinking, you mentioned throughout this conversation that you have a daughter. Like, when you have gone through an experience like this, like, what does it do for your perception of how we as a society view beauty and image, and particularly in the context of raising a daughter where we have like teenage girls who are like just, you know, having problems galore. I literally saw a special, it might have been on the Daily Show, where plastic surgeons were having girls as young as like 15 come in and say, "I want you to make my eyes look like they do in my Instagram filters."
That's wild. I think, you know, my daughter, I think, again, and I will just frequently say this over and over and over, because I think there is power in it. And I think the biggest thing is you could do is you can just always just model, model. And I don't mean modeling like a model, like, I mean, like literally just go out into the world and let them see you navigate and deal with this stuff. And I listen, I'm open with my daughter in a sense of where I'm telling her, I'm like, yeah. Somebody on social media made this comment the other day about me, right? Somebody said that I look like an avocado, like and I was like, I like avocados, so that's okay. I love avocado. I eat avocado all day long, bro. Like, cool, like whatever. Like, I mean, people say mean shit. So I think the biggest thing is my daughter sees the way that I handle people staring at me, people looking at me. And the thing that I have learned to do is realize, like, listen, man, there was a point early in my recovery where I went down that rabbit hole of I'm never going to be this. I'm never going to be that. I don't look this way. I don't look that way. Whatever. I spent all that energy and time worried about that stuff. And eventually I started practicing simple gratitude, just daily gratitude, and was able to distract my mind, and I didn't put a lot of emphasis on that stuff. And the more I got into the world, the more I was able to see that, yeah, there's a lot of people that are going to say some cruel things, a lot of people that did look at me weird, and people that avoided me. There was 100% of that. But more than that, I found people that were down to roll with me, down to kick it with me. And then I started, you know, dating, because I was, you know, 19 when I was hurt, and 20, 21, 22. And then, you know, I was, you know, listen, you know, I was able to, you know, all right, you know, she looks good, you know, she looks good. And oh, she's paying attention to me, and okay, cool. And then you just break up because of normal things. Like, but it was never because it was like, oh, your scars. I mean, and listen, there was a level of vulnerability I had to learn in that sense, right? It's just being able to show somebody my scars, like outside of what they can obviously see on my face and on my head and on my hands, but like my arms, my back, my legs. And then, you know, the more that I got out there, the more I realized it's not even about the physical. It's about who you are as a person. That's what it's really about. And then fast forward, you know, however many years it was after I was injured, I find myself listed in one of People Magazine's Sexiest Men Alive. And to me, it was like, I go on dancing and people are like sending me messages, and I'm like, oh, it has not. I mean, then at that point, like, yeah, I'm not saying that like my scars, like, you know, like I'm not attractive to some people. I'm sure I am. But what I quickly realized for me, which mattered more to me, was it's who you are as a person that truly matters. That's sexy. That's beauty. And for my daughter, I'm constantly talking to her about the person that she is. About this is what beauty really is. So, and she sees the way I handle it in public. She sees that kids come up to me always and they're like, "Yo, what happened to you?" Or, you know, people stare in public, or people come up to me and they constantly ask me if I'm Seal, the singer. And I'm like, wrong one. Nope, not me.
You should say yes sometime. Like, it's see what happens.
Oh, dude. No. I have said yes. So like one time, So it started, this one dude started this nonsense of like, are you SEAL? And I was like, wait, what? And he was like, yeah. And I was like, no, dude. And this dude was not going to take no for an answer. So I was like, fine, I am. And when I realized that a lot of people out there in the world, like you could tell them like, no, I'm not SEAL. And they won't buy it. So I just started, all right, fine. You know, yes, I am. And people were like, go away. And I'm like, cool. And then one day it backfired. I was hanging out with some friends at a bar. I was living in LA at the time. And this dude walks up to my friend and he hands her, this wasn't that long ago. He hands her, this is like 7 or 8 years ago. I mean, iPhones or cell phones could take very good photos, but this dude had like a disposable camera. And he walks up to her and he's like, can you take a picture with me and your boyfriend SEAL? And she looked at me because two things were wrong. One, she knew I wasn't SEAL, and two, I'm not her boyfriend. And she looks at me and I'm like, just take the photo because he's going to walk away as soon as you take it. Don't even try to spend time explaining it to this dude. So she takes the photo. She hands the camera to him and I'm thinking, all right, he's out. Nope. This dude turns and looks at me and he talks about how my music has been so instrumental in his life and how it's like saved him. And he's like, puts his hands on my shoulders. He's getting emotional. And I'm like, all I could think about is, oh shit, like, how do I get myself out of this scenario? Right. So trust me, I've done that. And now after that experience, I'm like, people are like, are you SEAL? And I'm like, no.
Yeah.
But the cool thing is my daughter sees how I'm able to have fun with it. And I, like I said, I'm constantly telling her there's always going to be somebody that's got something to say. I don't care what it is. Like, somebody's always got something to say. You got to operate from a different place. And that has to be your foundation that you function from. And so, you know, I think, you know, my daughter has, and it is tough. It's a tough society for kids and especially young ladies. And, you know, I think, you know, even the girls that I coach, I mean, I constantly every now and then will break off into stories and tell them stories about, you know, just different things and experiences. But I think that they see that, you know, like, they like being around Coach JR, right? Coach JR is cool. Coach JR is fun. Coach JR will push them, but Coach JR has like this gear. Like, they like that. And I think it's just getting these kids to understand that there's so much more to beauty than a filter, than what you see on social, what you see on TV, whatever's depicted, wherever it may be. Just trying to just show them that, listen, just be true to who you are and what you are, and everyone else will find you somehow.
Well, let's not forget that SEAL is married to Heidi Klum also.
Well, was.
Was. Then, you know. I can't, but it's kind of like, oh, it's like, well, great. If SEAL can marry Heidi Klum, I think I'll be all right.
I mean, you know, he's got what, 20 kids with her or whatever it is, you know, I mean, he's doing all right, yeah. You know, he's doing all right. And listen, man, listen, you know, I've had my fair share of, you know, I mean, you look at my wife and, you know, even when I was dating and it was like, you know what, I did all right. And so, it's just one of those things where it's like, it's, you know, to me, man, I just always like to operate from, you know, who I am and what the only thing I know to be, which is authentically who I am and who I want to be to people, and the rest will take care of itself.
Yeah. Well, that makes a beautiful place to wrap up our conversation. I feel like I could talk to you for hours on end. So I have one final question for you, which is how we finish all of our interviews at the Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Authentically being themselves. I think the ability for someone to, you know, to have clarity in who they are, what they want to be, I think is one of the most powerful and beautiful things that you could be, right? Just being clear and distinctive about who you are, who you want to be, and not wavering about that, and not letting anything shake that, and just always operating from that place, to me is like one of the things that, it's just so distinct and so honorable. And you know, that's to me what I think is, you know, makes someone dope.
Yeah. Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your story, your wisdom, and your insights with our listeners. This has been really breathtaking. Like I said, this has been one of those conversations that I will go back and listen to multiple times. It was so much fun, and I just enjoyed talking to you so much. So thank you.
Yeah.
Where can people find out more about you, your book, your work, and all that?
Well, you know, I love, thank you for having me on, man. Thank you for creating the platform and sharing it with me, for me to connect with your audience. And, you know, I love conversations. I feel the same way about this conversation. I love conversations, and I just encourage people to hit me up on social at @IamJRMartinez so we can just continue the conversation. I mean, I think, you know, social media sometimes, you know, it just becomes this thing I love to create connection with people and have conversation with people and have, you know, provoking prompts for thoughts and, you know, and jokes and whatever. But for the most part, just encouraging people to come hit me up on social, man, and let's just keep the conversation going. No matter what it is you want to know, I feel like I'm a pretty approachable dude. Hit me up.
All right. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this, AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The Four Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.